I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network. Hello and welcome to Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. Today we're covering a brilliant subject, Hadrian's Wall. When one of our listeners requested we look at it on Cunning Cast, I thought it was a brilliant idea because, like Stonehenge, it's one of our great ancient monuments and treasures, a subject of abiding interest, and guess what? There's still so much we don't really know about it. Only 5% of it has been excavated, 7% is visible today. There's so much more we can know. So I've invited two brilliant Hadrian's Wall experts to speak to me today so we can really interrogate more about how and why Hadrian's Wall was built, by who, and also what it means to us today. Was it really built as a barrier between England and Scotland, or is the truth far more interesting and nuanced than that? I've got leading archaeologist Professor Richard Hingley.
We have a lot of units from Germany and Spain on Hadrian's Wall. We have Tigris boatmen from Iraq, actually at Wall's End. We have people from right around the Mediterranean and right across the areas of Europe, which were conquered by the Romans.
And collections curator for Hadrian's Wall at English Heritage, Francis McIntosh.
It's a bone leg from a doll that was an articulated doll, so it would have had hinges on two legs and two arms. And I think we too often forget about the other people were all around the wall, you know, these wider families. And children, of course, had toys, didn't they, in the past, but they don't often survive. So that leg is amazing.
Anyway, before we get into that, Melissa, my producer's here for a chat. Hello, Melissa. Hadrian's Wall, eh?
Hadrian's Wall. Well, as you say, someone popped it onto the Twitter feed, didn't they? Onto the, I should say, X. And you said, absolutely, let's do it.
Yeah.
Straight away. Yeah. How many times have you been? You must have been a few times.
Oh, a load of times. I've filmed there an awful lot. I must admit, I've never walked the whole thing, but I've walked an awful lot of it.
We want more of them, don't we? More suggestions. Bring them on. Bring them on.
Silly and serious.
But actually, something you mentioned about a wall, the concept of the wall is really fascinating, isn't it? It piqued your interest.
Yeah, very much so. Well, if you think of the Berlin Wall and how profoundly important that was to the whole world, and of course, Trump's wall, that speaks volumes. They all do, don't they? Often a lot of what they've got to say is pretty nasty, but they do speak volumes. They affect our perception of huge areas of the world. And I'm absolutely convinced that exactly the same must have been true during the time that Hadrian's Wall was practical and functioning.
Talking of the Berlin Wall, there is a brilliant fact about Baldrick and the Berlin Wall. Please tell us.
I had a friend who was an MP, and she was around in Berlin at the time the wall fell, and sprayed on the wall were the words, "Don't worry, Baldrick has a cunning plan." And after it fell, she brought me back a little tiny bit of the wall with a bit of the letter B for Baldrick on it, which I still have.
That's literally amazing. That is my best Baldrick fact of the day. Thank you.
Richard, what is it about Hadrian's Wall that really draws you in, that's kind of made it your life's work?
Hadrian's Wall is a really prominent monument. I suppose when people think about ancient monuments in Britain, they think about Stonehenge and Hadrian's Wall. It's one of the two famous monuments in England. It's also got a considerable time depth incorporated in it. We tend to think about the Roman period, particularly we think about the Roman archaeology of the wall. One of the things that really fascinates me is that when the Romans cease to control Britain, the wall doesn't just disappear. It's still a very, very substantial monument that survives for centuries and centuries and centuries. And people have taken a deep interest in it really throughout time. So right from the end of the Roman Empire right down to the modern day. And I think it's the Roman history and also the time depth, you know, in the landscape of Hadrian's Wall that really draws me to it.
How about you, Francis? What is it that tickles you about Hadrian's Wall?
For me, it's the fact that so many people lived there for such a long time. So we've got, you know, the however many thousands of soldiers when the wall was fully manned, but it's all of the families and the other civilians who lived around the settlements. And we've just got so many bits of evidence to use to tell the stories of those people's lives. It just, it's really exciting. It's a great opportunity to be able to, yeah, tell that, and not just of the soldiers' lives. And then I love hearing about when people have been discovering the wall and getting excited about it, you know, throughout the centuries.
What actually is Hadrian's Wall? I mean, I know that sounds a bit daft, but, you know, let's get down to basics. What is it?
Well, it's a lot more than a wall. So actually, that's a really good question to get in at the beginning. It is a wall. It's 73 modern miles long, or 80 Roman, and it ran from Wall's End in the east to Bowness and Solway on the west. But along that wall, which at maximum height was about 4.6 metres, at every Roman mile there was a mile castle, almost like a little mini fort. And in between each mile castle were two turrets every third of a mile. They're even minier forts. And then also along its length, there are around about 16 forts, which would have held between 500 and 1,000 men, depending on the size of it. So it's this huge construction of the wall with mile castles and turrets. And then to the north of it was a ditch. To the south of it was the military road, or the military way where a lot of the transport would come on. And then just even further south was a huge mound, ditch and mound construction that we now call the Vallum, which nobody really understands. But that earthwork to the south is about 35 metres wide. So the whole kind of width of the wall corridor, as we would call it now, was huge, taking up a big swathe of land, cutting across that neck of Britain.
We also have some civil settlements connected with the forts, and they develop over time. So these are communities that actually come to settle with the soldiers living in the forts, unofficial families and traders, people connected with the military in general terms. So we have quite a sort of almost an urbanized landscape following the south of the wall.
So it would have been full of people.
Yeah, absolutely. The wall and its introduction to the landscape would have increased the population hugely. I think there's estimates saying that the soldiers on the wall with their followers, you know, represented 20 to 30% of the population in that whole area, which, can you imagine all of a sudden that influx and the impact that would have had on people's lives? You know, it was potentially fairly not densely populated, you know, not, we wouldn't say sparsely because there were lots of communities there, but this sudden influx of people from all over the empire would have been pretty mind-blowing, I think.
So what was going on in Britain at the time that it was built, Richard?
Britain, by that stage, had been part of the Roman Empire, or the south of Britain had been part of the Roman Empire for decades. And the Romans had conquered all of southern Britain. They held on to Wales. The military still occupy areas of northern Wales, and they also occupy some areas of what is now northern England. So the Romans haven't entirely conquered the sort of north and west of the area they control, but they do control all the land up to the line of Hadrian's Wall, and actually a bit beyond. And across the southern lands, they really managed to subdue the Britons. When I say subdue, quite a lot of the leaders of the peoples in Britain, so we have multiple peoples, the leaders of those people have actually been incorporated into the Roman Empire because they're running their own communities. They've been given control of their own peoples. Now, each people extends across an area equivalent roughly to a modern county, and some of them are famous names, the Iceni, the Cacciavillani in the south. Basically, a lot of those peoples have been incorporated into the empire and are beginning to build urban centres to run their peoples. This doesn't happen across the West and the North particularly. And as we get beyond Hadrian's Wall, we have lands that the Romans attempted to conquer earlier in the conquest period and withdrew from. And in those areas to the north of Hadrian's Wall, we have some Roman forts. So the Romans are holding down the land using forts and roads, but the peoples are still quite resistant to Roman control.
Yeah, that kind of undermines an image I think an awful lot of people have about Hadrian's Wall. It's a dividing line between England and Scotland. But Francis, there weren't even any Scots in Scotland at that time, were there?
No, exactly. And Scotland didn't exist, you know, in the Roman period. It was just the line that the Romans thought they could hold and feel comfortable with. They'd been in that area. They'd got up to kind of the northern parts of England since the 70s AD. And it was the Emperor Hadrian who came to power in 117 who, according to the Historia Augusta, decreed that the wall would be built in 122 AD. And it's a sensible point. It's the narrowest neck, of our island. It's the Tyne Solway Isthmus. And it was just to kind of demarcate the land. But they did have and continue to have forts. We call them outpost forts north of the wall. And that's to help, as Richard said, kind of subdue, you know, the unruly barbarians, as the Romans would have called them. And so we know it's not so clear cut as empire, not empire, in that sense.
Yeah, you used a funny little phrase there. You say it was used to demark the land, which is not a really very good reason for that massive piece of engineering on its own, is it? What do you think the thinking was behind the apparatchiks of the Roman Empire when they built the wall?
Gosh, that is the question, isn't it? I mean, Hadrian, when he comes into power, is completely different to his predecessors. You know, he's called the Consolidator Emperor. He stops expanding like all his predecessors had. He even gives up a little bit of territory, you know, controversial. And in other parts of the provinces of the empire, he draws lines using rivers or mountain kind of lines. In the German Limes, the German frontier, it's a turf rampart with stakes on top. For Hadrian's Wall in Britain, why does it become this monumental wall? We have no real idea. We've only got one source from the past, which even tells us it was Hadrian that built it. We use inscriptions to kind of back that up. But all it says, and this is a quote from the Historia Augusta, which was written about 200 years after Hadrian, it says that Hadrian put many things to right and was the first to build a wall 80 miles long from sea to sea to separate the barbarians from the Romans. So, I mean, it could have done that in many ways. And there's been arguments, oh, there weren't enough trees to do it in wood. But the logistics of building something out of stone is really huge. So did it mean they were more unruly north of that line than German Limes? I don't think that's what we agree.
Richard, who were the people who were on the other side of the wall? Was it the Picts?
Initially, when the wall's built, it probably wasn't the Picts, because we don't hear about the Picts in classical texts until later in the Roman period. And they were definitely a very important collection of different peoples who were anti-Roman to the north of the wall in later Roman history. Earlier on, we hear about the Caledonians, who were the sort of northern people beyond the wall. So they were beyond Edinburgh and Glasgow. But we have a series of peoples beyond the wall. The Picts are a later people, and they became a major threat to Rome later in history. I think one of the reasons they're so prominent in people's views of the wall is because of the issue of Hadrian's Wall being called the Picts' Wall throughout the medieval period. And people still pick that up today. I mean, people still talk about the Picts' Wall. But it's important. Our understanding is the Picts are actually slightly later in history than the building of the wall. So they become significant later in the Roman period, but they probably aren't there north of the wall when Hadrian's having the wall built.
Couldn't people who wanted to attack the Romans just go round the wall?
No, because basically the wall is extended at the west, at least, down the Cumbrian coast. So there's a series of forts and other installations actually down the west coast to Maryport and beyond. And that's actually controlling access across potentially from southwestern Scotland or from Ireland. The other thing that's very important is, as well as the Roman military, we tend to focus a lot of attention on the soldiers and military campaigning, but we have a navy in Britain called the Classics Britannica. Now, it's actually part of the military. It's not a very distinct organization like a modern navy. Our military and our navies are completely distinct things. The military have control of the Classis Britannica, but it's a collection of soldiers and ships that are used to patrol the coast off Britain. And basically, they will control any potential access round the wall. So basically, you can't actually go round the wall because the Romans will come and sink you and kill you.
One of the curious things about the wall, which I only learned very recently, was that the original wall didn't last very long, rather like Oliver Cromwell's attacks on royalty. The wall was slighted.
Yes, if you believe that it was completely abandoned, it's because when emperors change, policies change. As Hadrian had come in and consolidated the borders, his successor, Antoninus Pius, said, no, I'm going to try and get more of what we now see as Scotland, more of Britannia. And he moved up and built a new line. So he built the Antonine Wall, as we know it now, that was completely out of turf, and it runs roughly Edinburgh to Glasgow. And that was occupied for about 20 years.
So where is it in relation to Hadrian's Wall?
So it's north of Hadrian's Wall. It runs between Edinburgh and Glasgow. Roughly. And so it was to try and bring more of the island of Britannia into the Roman Empire. But then Antoninus Pius dies, the next emperor, change of policy again, and they come back down to Hadrian's Wall. So there is evidence archaeologically that lots of repairs had to be made to Hadrian's Wall. And as you said, parts of it were slighted. But I think there is still an argument that there might have been at least a skeleton crew around in the frontier zone in that 20-year period. But it's quite interesting. Yeah, the huge effort to build it. It only lasts 15 years. They move up, they come back. But then once they come back from the Antonine Wall, they're there through till the end.
What's it made out of, Richard?
It's made out of stone. The curtain wall is made out of stone, but Francis explained that we have the vallum, which is a big earthwork, and we also have the ditch to the north of Hadrian's Wall. So the main structure, the curtain wall, which everybody knows, the really famous thing going over the crags in the centre of the line of the wall, is built out of local sandstone. And so are the mile castles and the forts along the wall. Initially, along the western third of the wall, they actually built it out of turf. And there's quite a debate about why that might have been. One idea is that stone is very common across the crags, and they may have transported stone down to the east too to build this quite monumental Roman stone wall. Further west, stone is a bit more difficult to get as you get across to Carlisle. So in that area, they may have just built this turf ramparts and dug the ditch and the vallum to create a barrier, and then they come back later and reconstruct it in stone. I think a major thing that we need to think about is that in Roman terms, and we know this from the speech Hadrian gave in North Africa, building in stone is higher status than building in turf or timber. So the Romans, across the early phases of the conquest of Britain, are usually building their fortifications in earth and timber. They come back quite often in the late first century and start building in stone. Now, Hadrian's Wall, the majority of Hadrian's Wall is built in stone. So it's a really impressive, substantial structure. And that's coming back to an issue that Francis mentioned earlier, that it's really a very, very special frontier, because we have Roman frontiers around the whole of the boundaries of the Roman Empire, right across northern and central Europe, across the Near East and across North Africa. But Hadrian's Wall is really the most monumental, substantial stone wall that the Romans built. And we have to think about why they would do that in Britain. I have some ideas myself, but it comes back to why they built this wall in the first place. Why does Britain require a really monumental, really impressive stone wall? And it may be partly the identity of Britain in the Roman mind, which is something that really interests me. And Hadrian's trying to make a particular statement. But coming back to your question, the wall is, I mean, when it's completed, the main part of the wall, the curtain wall, and the fortifications along it are built in stone with elaborate arches to carry roads through the wall. But we have to remember the vallum. And the vallum is really important because it's a massive earthwork. And actually, to construct that would probably be equivalent in labour to constructing the whole of the curtain wall. So we mustn't forget that earthwork structure.
You say we mustn't forget it, but what was it for?
I tend to think, I mean, I have a sort of slightly eccentric, crazy idea about the vallum, and I don't know that it goes down very well with some other people. I mean, to me, Hadrian's Wall is actually there because the Romans are very keen and celebrate the idea of the ocean. I mean, effectively, Hadrian's Wall is there partly because the Romans have failed to reach the North Sea. I mean, they've tried to conquer the whole of Britain 40 years earlier, and they've had to withdraw. And the Vallum controls water. I mean, it's a major ditch, a really substantial ditch with banks either side, and all the springs and watercourses along the wall will have been channeled into the Vallum. It's not a canal. You know, you'd have standing water in the Vallum in various places. It doesn't hold standing water that you could sail a boat along. It goes up and down, you know, with the contours. But I think it's partly symbolic of Roman identity, and it's partly defensive, because to cross the Vallum, you would have to go across a crossing, and the crossings are controlled by military units. Somebody fell into the Vallum when they were digging it at the west end of Hadrian's Wall in the 1930s, and he wasn't hurt, but they had to get a ladder to get him out. And if you've fallen into the Vallum, you know, if you were trying to approach the Roman military and they didn't like you, they'd definitely spear you without any doubt, and you'd die in the Vallum.
You're listening to Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson, talking Hadrian's Wall this week with my very special guests, the wall worshippers, Richard Hingley and Francis McIntosh. We've been talking so far about the standing archaeology, the wall itself. But Francis, you're very familiar with the small finds, aren't you? Talk me through a couple of them.
I think you can only make sense of walls and structures by looking at the objects that were used there. And that's what tells us, you know, what people's lives are like. So I had a feeling you might ask me, you know, pick my top few, which is always so hard. It's like, you know, choosing a favourite child.
All right, well, I'll ask you that question. Tell me your top few.
I'm going to go for one general group, which is a real fudge as to start with. But we have a lot of graffiti on pottery. So it's Roman graffiti, you know, and often the graffiti from Pompeii is really famous, isn't it? But the graffiti from pottery on Hadrian's Wall is often people's names. So it's the names of the normal people, probably the people who couldn't afford to put up a huge inscription or a big altar. And they're just marking their bowl, because if they're a soldier, they're sharing a room with seven other men. There's eight of them in their contubernia. And so it gives us the names of the real people. And we found a graffito on a piece of Samian ware, which is the red shiny pottery that came from Gaul, so modern day France. And it's the name, and he's identifying himself as a slave. So I think sometimes, you know, these individual names are where you can get the really exciting pieces from. I'm then going to pick an object from Corbridge. Corbridge is one of my favourite sites. It's a town just south of the wall, but part of the frontier. And it's a very rare piece. It's evidence for children on the frontier. And it's a bone leg from a doll that was an articulated doll. So it would have had hinges on two legs and two arms. And it's just, you know, it's amazing. You can see the toes where they've carved it. And I think we too often forget about the other people were all around the wall, you know, these wider families. And children, of course, had toys, didn't they, in the past, but they don't often survive. So that leg is amazing.
One of my favourite finds, it's a little piece of sculpture, and it's like three people who look really, really cold, and they've dressed up with hoods and everything just to keep the cold out. It's almost comic. It is comic to me.
So that's the Geni Cucullati from Housesteads. So the hooded gods or hooded spirits, so they are kind of known along the wall. And one of the kind of exports from Britain was our wool and our hooded cloak, our Birrus Britannicus. People would laugh and say, well, of course you needed it up there. And it's these three hooded gods. And yeah, we have that up in the museum at Housesteads, and they're amazing, aren't they? There's a little individual 3D sculpture of one from Bird Oswald, which the staff always say is their favourite, and they see him as their little mascot from Bird Oswald. But no, I love that sculpture. It's brilliant.
They look like those onesies that everyone bought last year online.
Exactly. I think they would have loved it if it could have been heated as well.
Yeah. Richard, tell me about Vindolanda. It's probably the one name that a lot of people will know from Hadrian's Wall. A lot of the stuff there was discovered fairly recently, wasn't it? What is it?
Vindolanda is a Roman fort with a very, very substantial civil settlement attached. Sometimes we call the civil settlements Vici, which is a Latin word, but civil settlement is probably better. So what you have there is you have nine Roman forts, one on top of each other. And the first one is established probably in the mid-70s AD. And the first few forts, so every time a unit changes, now this is an issue with the Roman military, so they bring a unit into control to build a fort and to control that area of land. And quite often after 10 years or so, that unit is moved on somewhere else. They might be sent to Germany or Spain. They might be sent right across the empire to the east. A new unit comes in. Quite often they build a new fort. So the early phases of Interlander, we have a number of timber forts because they're building these forts in timber. And the ground is really waterlogged at Interlander. It's a wonderful place to dig. They only dig in the summer. Well, they dig in the spring and summer. It's very, very, very wet. There's a major spring at Vindolanda, which actually creates major waterlogging in the ground. And the forts were built on top of each other. Now, the result of this is we have really wonderful preservation at Vindolanda because most archaeological sites, we only find substantial structures. So we find stone buildings. We do find traces of timber buildings. They're usually reduced to post holes that are dug into the ground, and that's all you find. So at Vindolander, the society living there, very large proportion of the objects they possess are made of organic materials, so timber, leather, those sort of things. On a dryland archaeological site, they didn't survive. At Vindolander, they survive really well and they get buried because they've been walked along, so the air doesn't desiccate. And Vindolander has produced really substantial remains from these timber forts. So we find the remains of barrack blocks, timber buildings. We find the remains of the defences really well preserved. We find sandals from the people who live there. The sandals are really important because they tell us that as well as the soldiers, the male soldiers, you had to be male to join the Roman military. We have women and children there. So presumably the unofficial families of the soldiers, you couldn't officially marry in the Roman military, but soldiers did. And the wives and children probably quite regularly lived in the civil settlement outside the fort. But we also have the Vindolanda letters. And a lot of people know about these things because they're just preserved pieces of wood on which, in ink, we have messages, and they tell us so much about life in Roman times. I mean, some of them are very famous. There's a birthday invitation from one commanding officer's wife to another commanding officer's wife. We have a fragment of Virgil, so the children of the commanding officer seem to be being taught to write in Latin using this classical author called Virgil. And there are so many stories that you can tell about people who lived at that site 2,000 years ago.
I think Vindolanda shows what we've lost from the rest of the site. I'm very good friends with the curator there, Barbara, and you know, she often says, oh, they found another shoe. You know, she's got so many shoes, she almost doesn't know what to do with them. But Vindolanda is special. It's amazing. But it's only special because the material has survived and they have found it. It's not that the people at Vindolanda in the Roman period were doing anything different to anywhere else on the wall. So what Vindolanda is wonderful for is it gives us a window to show people exactly what we've lost from Corbridge, from Housesteads, from Carrabruff, you know, from all these other sites. Because what we see, the evidence that gets to us, huge chunks of the way people, you know, lived and worked and ate and, you know, created objects is lost, isn't it? We get pottery and then, as I say, these rare, you know, other organics. And lots of the things we, you know, we've lost, it means people struggle sometimes to understand life and how the daily life occurred. But Vindolanda shows that because they have everything. They have the baskets, you know, they have the barrel staves. It's just, oh, it's, yeah, amazing.
I was filming near Hadrian's Wall about 6 or 7 years ago and popped in just to say hi, really. And the archaeologists were incredibly excited because it's so waterlogged. They'd come to a bit in their trenches where there wasn't one leather sandal or five leather sandal. It was almost like a shoe shop. It was just quite extraordinary. Every moment they were just pulling out more and more of these leather sandals. It's a treasure trove for archaeologists, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I think one of the things that strikes me following up what Francis is saying is that the Vindolanda letters tell us so much about society. I'm not belittling the importance of the sandals. I think they're almost equally significant. But the military in Britain, we have all these forts along Hadrian's Wall, further north and further south, and they were all communicating with their relatives and with their friends elsewhere in the province in Latin by writing letters. I mean, that's what Vindelinder actually tells us. And if we had, we do have a few other sites at which we have similar things. We have similar letters in Carlisle, and we have some material from London too. If we can find more sites which had that sort of documentation, our knowledge of Roman Britain would really be transformed.
How amazing would it be to find the other end of a Vindelinder correspondence, hey?
Oh, that would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
You know, if we found at Wall's End the other part of the party invite, or one of the recent finds for Vindelinder, they realised one of the commanding officers is very keen into kind of gardening and vegetable production. And I'd love to show the other end of the letter that, you know, was a response to him.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One thing we haven't talked about yet is why Hadrian's Wall is exactly where it is. I'm right in saying, aren't I, that there's a colossal piece of geology in the middle of it, which makes it a perfect place to put a zonking great wall.
Yeah, so there's probably two reasons, or the main reason first is it's the shortest gap, you know, it's a 73 mile long, and the Romans would have sent out surveyors to pick that line. They already had approximately that line with the earlier forts along from Corbridge through to Carlisle, but they would have seen shortest gap. They send the surveyors out, and they, as you say, they're taking advantage of the natural geography and geology, taking the line of the wall over the central section. That's the windsill, and a lot of people have heard of the windsill, and that's the crags that Richard mentioned of the, you know, the wall snakes across. And most of the geology along the line of Hadrian's Wall is Carboniferous. So it's the plants, you know, from millions of years ago laid down. But the windsill is igneous, and that's a much harder dolerite. And it's pushed up, which has caused these crags. So it really gave them an extra advantage, I suppose, if you think that the wall was defensive. I imagine the builders were probably cursing the surveyors because there was some steep inclines that they had to build up against.
It's a lovely old word, that word sill, isn't it? It's like windowsill. It's this great chunk of very dependable stone.
Yes, exactly. And it comes out on the Hadrian's Wall, but it comes out along the coast as well. You can see, you know, they've traced it along, as you say, like this big line.
I think the other thing, we shouldn't focus entirely on the uplands. That's the most impressive part of Hadrian's Wall, and it's the most famous. But the east and western end are on much lower ground. And I tend to think, if you look at the course of Hadrian's Wall, it really follows the rivers. And if you think about the fact that people before the Romans come to Britain are actually travelling around quite a lot, if you actually want to get from the east to the west coast or the west to the east coast, you're going to follow the rivers. So when you look at that line that Hadrian's Wall takes, you might not go up Windsill if you're actually trying to get between, say, Wall's End, you know, that end of where the wall is built, and Carlisle. You might stick to the valley, but the line of the wall is really following just to the north of a communication route. I also tend to think, although this isn't fashionable really, that that communication route is significant before the Romans come to Britain. So the fact Hadrian's Wall is built there, it's replacing an earlier communication route that Romans construct called the Stain Gate. We think the Stain Gate was established in the 80s or 90s, so two or three decades before Hadrian's Wall was built. Some people say the Stain Gate before Hadrian's Wall was built is really a previous frontier. So Hadrian's Wall is supplementing the Stain Gate because they built all these fortifications along that line. And the Stain Gate has a road and forts. It's a sort of previous form of frontier structure.
Hi, this is Tony Robinson bringing you my Cunning Cast. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating or a review. And do take a look at our back catalogue. There's a growing selection of shows there to keep you company. Everything from Stonehenge to why pies were invented, why do our dogs love us so much, and the legend that is Miriam Margolyes. I'm sure you're going to find something you like, so why not take a lucky dip? Go on, it won't hurt you.
It's very easy, isn't it, to think of Hadrian's Wall in the Roman times as one event that happened at one moment. But we'll talk about the wall's later history in a bit. But during Roman times, it had its own history then as well, didn't it?
The construction starts. We think it lasts for all of Hadrian's reign. So it takes 15 years or so to build the elements of the wall that reach from coast to coast. It's possible certain sections of the wall aren't completed by that time, and the turf wall isn't replaced in stone, probably during Hadrian's reign. Then we have the move forward under Antoninus Pius to the Antonine Wall, and Hadrian's Wall is probably maintained with a sort of skeleton military force. And then after that, they fall back again to the line of Hadrian's Wall, and we know they do some repair work and restore it. And then we go on in time. You could see the history of the wall from the 140s or 150s AD through to the early 5th century is a period of sort of continuity to an extent, because it looks as if the wall is maintained most of the time, and we have regular rebuildings of the wall. You can anticipate that a structure like Hadrian's Wall needs constant repair, so the wall itself subsides in places, and the buildings and the forts need restoring and keeping standing, and whole forts are rebuilt to an extent, and one or two forts are added to the line at later dates. But we also have periods at which there's some political instability in Britain, and we have some inklings that there is trouble on Hadrian's Wall.
The wall is occupied, as Richard says, for a long time. There's many, many thousands of people there to stop potential trouble, and people often ask us, we get visitors asking us, oh, you know, did the wall ever get breached? Was it ever overrun? And there are a couple of sources that mention, you know, the wall being overrun, but they don't give us great amount of detail. Sometime after 180, Cassius Dio, who's a historian almost contemporary to that period, says that the tribes crossed the wall, which divided them from the Roman forts, and killed a general and the troops he had with them. So we don't know how many troops that means. You know, could it be a general who was just going between forts or had a small retinue, almost like a bodyguard, or does that mean they killed a whole unit? We have no idea, but we do know that at various points emperors are sent, you know, right up until particularly in the 4th century, emperors come up to the north of Britain to try and put down unrest, and that's due possibly either to activity north of the wall or breaching of the wall. And there was definitely a period in kind of archaeological work in the 50s, 60s, 70s, where archaeologists were very keen to try and tie down the evidence they were finding on sites to these specifically mentioned actions of overrunning of the wall. We particularly saw that at one of the sites of Corbridge, where any time there was kind of a layer of black that looked like it was a burning layer, they were trying to say, oh, it must be this, you know, 180 overrunning. Because in the south of Britain, Boudica, you know, the rebel queen, or, you know, however you describe it, she did sack and completely raze two or three cities. And there you genuinely can find, you know, the Boudican layer of destruction. But it's not that clear cut up on the wall, you know, and what does overrun mean? It could be 50 men coming over at one point. It could be 5,000. And so what evidence would that leave in the archaeology? It's really tricky to know. And obviously it's always nice, isn't it, if you can pin things to a specific date, but it's just not how the past works, is it, in our understanding of it?
No. It's funny that, isn't it? Because an awful lot of people have said to me something along the lines of, well, the great thing about archaeology is that it proves history. Well, it just doesn't, does it? My old friend Mick Aston said, you can't tell 1066, you can't tell the Norman invasion in the ground. No. All you can say is that over a period of about 70 years, the materials used to build cathedrals changed.
Yeah. It's the same, you know, maybe we've got a great find from Corbridge, which is called the Corbridge Hoard. It's a huge chest filled with armour that's buried sometime in the second quarter of the second century AD. And And when it was first found, the archaeologists said, oh, this was buried as the fort was being overrun and they were abandoning the fort so that the, you know, the barbarians didn't get hold of this resource. But there's absolutely no way that, you know, would have been packed in a hurry. That was a carefully packed amount of material. And it's there. It's trying to make the archaeology fit this timeline that they think they've got from the very, very sparse sources that we have.
Tell us a bit more about the Corbridge Hoard, because I don't think many people have even heard of it outside Corbridge.
No. So that is Corbridge's, you know, real treasure trove. It is like a time capsule, we say. So it's a huge chest, 2 meters by a meter and 2 meters deep. And it was jam-packed full with a type of armor called Lorica segmentata, which is segmented armor. And if you Googled Roman soldier, it's the armor they would be wearing. You see that on Trajan's column. It's segments, kind of strips of iron overlapping in a suit. And there was parts of 6 suits of that, which was confusing at first, but what it allowed archaeologists to do was understand how the armour was made and how it was worn and how it was repaired. It was known to exist from sculptural evidence. And basically what they found out was if one segment broke, you could just replace that section of the armour. You didn't have to get a whole new suit. So this hoard is probably the kind of stock of an armourer who was likely also a soldier. The Roman army, lots of those soldiers would have had kind of trades or second roles within the army. So he's collecting all these bits so that he can repair other suits of armour along the way. He also had a few bundles of spearheads. So the iron spearheads, which will be hafted onto a wooden shaft. The wooden shaft's the bit that breaks, and then you throw the wood away or it gets repurposed, but you're not going to just throw the iron spearhead away because that's really valuable. So he's collecting them together to rehaft a whole bunch of spears together. And he's packed it away for some reason. Richard talks about units moving around the empire, but we also know from those amazing Vindolanda tablets that small detachments of men or vexillations of men are sent away to, I don't know, escort the grain carriage, meet the general, you know, do a patrol. So he's maybe just packing it away because he's going away from Corbridge and thinks he's coming back. Where he went to and why he didn't come back, you know, we don't know, but that's a lovely mystery that we can, you know, pose to visitors.
It also, all this chat about armour raises the question for me, what were people wearing? Presumably the Romanised people weren't wearing togas and tunips. Tunips? Or turnips? What was I going to say? Tunics, right that far north.
I think you're right. On the whole, people probably aren't going to be wearing togas on the northern frontier. People wear warm clothes quite a lot. I mean, we have some fabric surviving from Vindolanda and other places in Britain. But I would emphasise the Corbridge treasure is actually connected with the legionary soldier. And one of the things that we'd really, really have to communicate to the public in Britain is that the majority of soldiers in Britain were actually auxiliary soldiers, not legionary soldiers. So the Roman military, as well as having a navy with sailors, has auxiliary units as well as legionary units. The legionary units are the high status units. So the Corbridge treasure is actually, the Corbridge hoard is connected with legionary soldiers. But the majority, almost all the soldiers on Hadrian's Wall, are going to be auxiliary soldiers. Auxiliary soldiers aren't Roman legionaries. They're still quite significant people. So the soldiers at Vindolanda, on the whole, are auxiliary soldiers. The soldiers at Halsteads are the same. And they wear slightly different armour. They're not as heavily armoured. They have slightly different weapons. They're still Roman soldiers, but we have to be aware of that. And what they wear in their sort of everyday lives when they're not actually on campaign or, you know, under control, I don't know if we really know. Do we, Francis?
No. So I'll just go back and say, I think I challenge you that we don't think it was solely legionaries who wore Lorica segmentata. That was thought at one point, but there's now been too many finds of Lorica segmentata sites where we don't think there were legionaries. But it is, yeah, you know, the legionary uniform. And the auxiliary soldiers who, you know, weren't the Roman citizens, they're coming in with different skills from across the provinces. They're wearing slightly different armour. There's, you know, a couple of classical sources about how you would always recognise a soldier, even if he was off duty. And that's from his boots. And he would often still always wear his belt. So you would hear a soldier coming, even if they weren't on duty and in full, I don't like to say uniform because it wasn't a uniform, you know, in full armour and full kit. But I think you would still recognise, because probably the tunic that they wore under their armour, they would wear and then belt up. And so you would still recognise a soldier in some ways. I think they would be wearing it's almost like, you know, an off-duty kind of persona, but they would be recognised, I think, as a soldier, and they'd want to be recognised as a soldier because they'd want to get the respect that they felt they deserve.
Francis, I don't know whether you'd suddenly put your academics hat on, but you just went, oh, I'm not going to call it a uniform because it wasn't a uniform. Well, what was it if it wasn't a uniform?
So the Roman army didn't issue a uniform. They would issue your armour, your shield, your weapons, which were taken out as deductions from your pay. But in terms of, you know, the clothing that you wore underneath it, socks or leggings or, you know, other bits, you were allowed to kind of slightly personalise. Your belt that you wore that was really key as a soldier, you could put your own studs and fastenings on to personalise it. Whereas, you know, that was not allowed at all, is it? And, you know, in the modern army, it's very much all regiment. So we do have this idealised view of a Roman army which looks every soldier looks identical, and that's absolutely not how it would have been. So we can't, it's really hard because you want, it's not an outfit, because that also gives the wrong idea, doesn't it? But it's not a uniform in the modern military sense at all. There'd be standardisation to some extent, but there's also personalisation, and, you know, particularly a army that's on campaign or at the end of the supply lines, there'd be the make do and mend. You know, that's what the Corbetord kind of shows you, doesn't it? He's got parts of six suits so that he can patch up the armour. But, you know, what if that segment is slightly more weathered than another one? It's not going to be that beautiful, pristine veneer then.
What we haven't mentioned at all is where all these people came from. I think most people by now will know that probably most of the soldiers up on Hadrian's Wall weren't British. But was that true of the auxiliaries as well? And as for the posh soldiers, where did they come from?
We have a lot of units from Germany and Spain on Hadrian's Wall. We have Tigris boatmen from Iraq, actually at Wall's End. We have people from right around the Mediterranean. So we have people from the North Mediterranean, the East Mediterranean, the South Mediterranean, and right across the areas of Europe, which were conquered by the Romans. But we don't only have auxiliary and legionary soldiers. We also have traders. One of the really famous people from Hadrian's Wall, if you're an archaeologist, is called Barates, and he was Palmyrian trader. So he came from right across the east of the Mediterranean, and he actually got married to a woman called Regina. Now, Regina was an ex-slave. Regina, interestingly, means queen, but she was an ex-slave. And we know from the inscription on her burial monument, she was a member of a people called the Cacciovallone. Now, the Cacciovallone, if you know your Roman Britain, were based in eastern England. So basically, she'd presumably travelled. She'd been, Barates had possibly bought her as a slave, it's quite possible, and brought her to South Shields, where she died at the age of 30 and was buried. So Barates was from right across the Mediterranean, very, very distant from where Regina came from.
So Francis, it's not fanciful then to say that there could have been black people manning Hadrian's Wall?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, as Richard said, there's soldiers coming from all over the empire, and that was a tactical decision by the Romans. So the Batavians, who Richard has mentioned, had a very big revolt because they were garrisoning the area they'd been recruited from. So the Roman policy was very much then changed to a unit that was recruited, say, from Batavia, from Holland, would be sent to work not in an area that they were from. So the British soldiers were never serving in Britain. And soldiers, say, from North Africa, we had them up on the wall. We even had an emperor whose skin would have been very dark, Septimius Severus, the emperor that we've mentioned, I think, before. So he's very late second into the early third century. He's one of the emperors who has to come to Britain to put down some of this unrest that's happening north of the wall. He's born from a North African family, becomes emperor and travels around, and he wouldn't have been the only man of dark skin up there. There's even in one of his memoirs, he talks about meeting what he calls an Ethiopian, which is the catch-all name that the Romans had for anyone of very dark skin. And he met this Ethiopian, as he says, in what is now Carlisle. So, you know, we had people on the wall from all over the empire, whether that's them coming through with the army or traders following the army, because the army is a real cash cow, isn't it? If you're making something that the army wants to buy, you've got to follow that army. It's a ready-made market that then stuck. The soldiers, when they have their day or two of leave, they can't pop down to the nearest huge town. So they're going to go to the civilian settlement outside or to Corbridge to spend their money on beer and other things.
Richard, when did the Romans leave Britain and why?
The Roman Empire is beginning, the Western Empire is beginning to fall apart under pressure from people beyond the frontiers of the empire in the late 4th, early 5th century. And we do believe that some military units are removed from Britain. Again, we need to think about the fact archaeology isn't a handmaiden of history, and it doesn't necessarily back up what history tells us. And if we look at the archaeology, I think what we get is a picture of rather greater continuity, because quite a lot of the forts along the wall, and actually the same is true in southern Britain too, some of the cities and the villas continue to be occupied and used well into the 5th century. And we can imagine that some communities are maintaining a form of Roman life into the post-Roman age. But also the decline of these things starts, you know, well before the early 5th century. So I'd argue there's a lot more continuity. And we can imagine that Roman Britain, I mean, Britain isn't really a Roman province anymore by the 420s or so. Things, you know, the cities are falling apart. The forts along the wall, a lot of them are still probably occupied, but military control, the sort of infrastructure, the organization of these military units, which has lasted for centuries in Britain, is beginning to fall apart, certainly by the 420s.
Okay, you've said when the Romans left Britain, even though you're not quite sure, but you actually haven't said why. What was this collapse within Rome that caused the contraction?
Well, Rome is in real trouble. The whole Western Empire is in trouble. And actually, the Eastern Empire survives for centuries and centuries and centuries after the collapse of the Western Empire. But I suppose if the pressure gets so great, I mean, they've already lost territories on the continent. Britain becomes something that is just a luxury. There are lots of Roman soldiers still in Britain. They may withdraw them gradually. They also have to send across senior military officers, you know, to keep the province secure. And I imagine, you know, these people are probably becoming rather precious because they need them to protect themselves and the core of the empire and to maintain whatever they can of the economy. So Britain, which has always been, you know, something that the Romans really wanted to keep control of, probably starts to seem rather a luxury. So in a way, you know, things are fragmenting.
So, okay, sometime round about 420, people up at Hadrian's Wall would have turned around and gone, oh, blimey, the Romans have gone. What happened to the wall, Francis?
I think if you were thinking about it in a modern terms, basically the empire did a cost-benefit analysis and realised Britain wasn't bringing in enough to justify the cost, and they needed to put those resources to defend other parts of their empire. And so troops had been reduced and reduced up on the wall. And the evidence at Burd Oswald, which is a site where they've done the most excavations, shows that it's the same people. There's no real gap in occupation from, you know, the late 4th to the 5th century. So I think a lot of the soldiers, who by that point were kind of generational families because they'd brought in a law that said sons had to follow their fathers in the trade, which was mainly, we think, to keep the army supplied with new recruits. So for them, they were Roman because they were part of the empire, but they were the people of Burd Oswald much more than they were part of the Roman Empire. And so when the empire left them, their lives were there. They've probably got land outside the fort. They've got connections. So they just continued on. That's what the evidence at Burd Oswald shows. And they don't continue to build and maintain the structures in the same way. Burd Oswald, a large wooden aisled hall is built on top of the fort. They don't, because they don't have maybe the infrastructure to do that. But they just continue on. And, you know, occupation has already shrunk in terms of numbers of people. You know, that continues. It's just a smaller number of people. And they're looking after their, you know, smaller area rather than it being part of one large imperial, you know, purpose. So it happens that way. And Gildas, who's writing in 540, so about 100 years or so afterwards, just in that, so what's that, four generations? Already, nobody understands or remembers what the wall was. They think that the wall was built after the Romans left. The Britons asked for help from the Romans to come back to build them a wall to help them keep the Picts out. So it's within four generations, already understanding has gone into mists of time. So it just shows they're very much then centred on what they need to do. They haven't got someone from Rome or Constantinople telling them what to do. So they just carry on doing their thing, but for them.
Richard, I know that one of the things that fascinates you is what happened to the wall and our perceptions of the wall after the Romans had left. Tell us a little bit about that.
From Geldas onward, the wall is well known. It survives very, very substantially into the 16th century. We have a description in the late 16th century describing the wall and the sort of central crags surviving, you know, way above head height. So the monument's still there and people will be aware of it. In the medieval period, we have some maps of Britain and they don't mark a lot. I mean, they mark particular urban centres, so London's always there, but Hadrian's Wall is marked on a number of these medieval maps, so people know it's really, really significant. It tends to be called the Picts' Wall by people, so it's not known as Hadrian's Wall, but people actually do know, the educated clerics and landowners know that Hadrian was associated with the wall, and they know that the wall was built by the Romans. So Gildas's story, you know, goes through time too. And by the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, we've got conflicts developing between England and Scotland. And I think it's worth thinking about those because we've talked a bit about the fact that England and Scotland aren't Roman things. You know, these countries didn't exist. They're medieval kingdoms. The Romans constructed Hadrian's Wall at the edge, towards the edge of their territorial control. But actually, is it a historical coincidence that England and Scotland developed to either side of the wall? It may not be entirely a historical coincidence because wall plays a major role in debates about English and Scottish identity in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. But the line of the boundary that develops between England and Scotland isn't actually along the line of Hadrian's Wall, but the wall is in the debatable lands, are the lands between England and Scotland. There are unsettled lands in which neither government to either side controls the land. And you've got a series of people who live in that landscape who are very keen on raiding their neighbours and stealing their cattle. The debatable lands continue right down to really to the reign of James I.
We can see that today, can't we? There are almost always debatable lands on no man's lands on either side of walls. In a way, it's the walls that throw up these questionable areas.
Yeah, so I wrote an article about Hadrian's Wall as a debatable land because that concept actually has been used quite a lot in literary studies to look at sort of debatable areas where identity isn't necessarily very well defined. And the wall comes down through time. After the 16th century, it continues to play major roles in the way the English think about themselves and the Scots think about themselves, and also in relation to the identities of the people living along the wall itself. And those things make the wall even more valuable than the Roman archaeology, which we've been focusing upon.
And nowadays, the wall is almost defined by the fact that it's heritage. It is, and I think all three of us have said it, it is one of the two great, in inverted commas, monuments of Britain. It's a subtle change, isn't it?
You know, since probably, you know, the 16th century when the study of the past really started to get going, and there's Camden and Cotton who are writing volumes, and it moves on from there. Now it's part of our past, it's our heritage, and people go and visit it to try and find out about their past. And, you know, I love that. There's so many people who live along the line of the wall and around the wall, and they see the wall as theirs, you know, which is just so amazing. What a monument.
Francis, do you have a cunning plan for the wall in the future?
Yes. So I'm going to be cunning and say two. So one, find a way to stop the cows and the sheep climbing on the wall, because they do more damage than the odd visitor who climbs on the wall. There's constant masonry repairs. But on a serious note, Hadrian's Wall is a World Heritage Site. You know, how amazing. It's a UNESCO, you know, designated monument. But the collections are not part of that designation, because monuments can't move, but collections can. So collections can't be part of the World Heritage Site. But I would like to remind people that we only know what people were doing in those buildings because of the collections. So the collections should be part of that designation. And David Breeze has been working on this, and there's lots of, I think you need to think of the monuments and the collections as one, because it's only when we look at them together that we understand what people were doing in those spaces.
Richard, a cunning plan.
We need to communicate through reenactment the various areas of the Roman Empire which the soldiers who lived along Hadrian's Wall would derive from. So We find that very difficult through reenactment because most of the reenactors we have on our archaeological sites are from Britain. English Heritage very positively brought some Italian reenactors to Halsteads a few years ago. Perhaps we could create a reenactment group that actually represents the people who actually lived and served on the wall.
I think that's a terrific idea. It would certainly blow a few minds. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Francis. Long may people visit Hadrian's Wall. If you haven't visited it or haven't been there for a long time, please go. If you want to join in the conversation, you can find me on X at Tony Robinson, and you can follow all our podcast news on X and Instagram at CunningCastPod. And please don't forget to follow this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. I'm Tony Robinson. This is My Cunning Cast, produced by Melissa Fitzgerald, and it's a Zinc Media production.